story of Jesus. What a friend we have in Jesus, all our sins and griefs to bear. What a friend we have in Jesus. Theologians, but not metaphysicians, wonder why the Bible is interpreted so broadly and so imaginatively, creating many religions, all claiming Jesus as their source. Lesson, Lecture 15, The Story of Jesus. Theologians, but not metaphysicians, wonder. Theologians wonder why the Bible is interpreted so broadly and so imaginatively, creating many religions and all claiming Jesus as their source. Interesting concept, isn't it? Just imagine that here is a man who has lived and done quite a marvelous thing, and in doing that, what has happened to him? He has created many people interested in him. He has created many people thinking that he's wonderful. Has anyone else done anything like that? I think, Ellen, it would be a smart thing if you would move Dodie now out of the sun. Sorry. Don't you think that'd be a smart thing to do? So just, Ellen, you move your chair away so Dodie has room to move today. Now, Dodie?
Yes, sir.
Move your chair thoroughly and soundly. A little more. Excellent. Excellent. Now, you just settle down for your long winter's nap. Theologians, but not metaphysicians, wonder why the Bible is interpreted this so broadly, but what does that mean? How many people have lived a life that have given spawn to so many philosophies, so many religions, so many cultures, so many attitudes? Well, actually, a lot. You look at Christianity and it has many offshoots, or undershoots, or inshoots, or what do you want to call it. Buddhism, it too has many shoots. We're not familiar with them because we're not in the Buddhist teaching. Judaism has many also. It has the formal, the informal, and all the other aspects of it. And now we can go into the teachings of the American Indians. The American Indians have as many teachings of a religion as there are tribes of Indians, because every tribe has its own recognition of the Great Spirit. And every tribe feels they have the right key into the relationship with the divine. Now, this goes true for the Eskimos. The Eskimos, each group has an individual who is their chief or their boss in their commune, and he has an idea of what religion's all about, and he espouses that to his group, and they follow it. All over the world this goes on, all over the world. We are not really concerned one way or another, but all over the world it goes on. And as it goes on all over the world, what does it do? It merely shows the unity in diversity and the diversity in unity. It shows how all groups of people want to believe in something greater than themselves, because they look at themselves and they say, if that's all there is, if that's the reason we're living, we're not living very well. And they're right. I think any human being who is satisfied with being a human being is not worthy of being a human being. A human being should be unsatisfied with himself. He should be constantly looking in meditation, introspection, at the inner self, and realizing that, hey, there is where it's all at. There is where his divinity stands. There is where the reality of himself stands. Now, this is what happens in many churches. The minister will say something, and some of the congregation will be upset about it, and they'll go out and start their own offshoot. Martin Luther did the same thing. He was very upset with the Catholic Church. He felt the Catholic Church had certain attitudes and ways of doing things that were not harmonious with him. So he went off and started his own church. And lo and behold, his own church had virtually every single one of the attributes of the mother church, of his former church. And what were the differences? What were the differences? The differences were insignificant. The differences were insignificant. You say, oh, they were significant. Because Martin Luther believed that man can go to God direct. Man can go to God direct, but he didn't teach it. He taught that the saints and the priests of the church and the bishops and various other people were necessary for people to make that transition. Zwingli did the same thing when he came out with his change in philosophy. All the other great religious leaders who founded new aspects of the Christian faith came up with the same thing. But you see, they all fell back on the one basic. And what was the one basic? The story of Jesus. And what was the story of Jesus? The story of Jesus was the story of a man who taught a philosophy and that they could live that philosophy. Now, where did the churches have their biggest hang-ups? Where did the churches have their biggest hang-ups? They had their biggest hang-ups when they went away from their founder. I mean, when they went away from Martin Luther or went away from Zwingli, when they went away from their founder, who is the founder of the Christian faith? Well, we like to think that Jesus was, you know. But, you see, Jesus gave a philosophy, and then other people came along and felt that they knew better how to teach the philosophy taught by Jesus. And so, what did they start doing? You know, it could be very boring teaching the same subject over and over and over and over again. So what do the teachers do to make it more interesting? They bring in their personality. They bring in other aspects. They have to enlarge the story and say, well, now Jesus never died on the cross. He married Mary Magdalene, went to France and had a family, and his family are still living there. You know, the generations of generations of the family of Jesus Christ are still living there. Well, isn't that fascinating? And what difference does it make? You see, the only difference that it makes is that you have a group of people who are very much at odds with other people. What would you think would be one of the primary things Jesus taught? He taught love, didn't he? Yeah. He taught forgiveness. He taught love your neighbor like yourself. And I don't think he should have said that. Because if he would have said, love your neighbor like you love God, it might have been a little more help. Because the people didn't really recognize yet that they were God. And so they were loving their neighbor like they loved themselves, and themselves were pretty tough people sometimes. Very tough to get along with. Think about this here, the theologians. What are theologians? Theologians are men and women and whoever who study the Bible and see how the Bible is constructed and see how the Bible can be lived and how the Bible can be taught and how the Bible can be verified and proven and made something that it's very wonderful for it to be. You know? Isn't that wonderful? Isn't that wonderful? What do you think the church should be? If you are a Buddhist, what do you think you should do? You should follow the teachings of the Buddha, right? Mm-hmm. The Buddha. Not the followers of Buddha, but the Buddha. And what did the Buddha say? Very little. Very little. Many people write things they said the Buddha said, but the Buddha never said that. The Buddha's perhaps greatest pronouncement was, I'm hungry, let's eat. After he had awakened from that mendicant monk life, he says, I've had enough of this. I've seen bliss. I've seen nirvana. And nirvana doesn't require of me that I flagellate myself and that I limit myself and that I call myself bad. He says, let's eat, let's party. You know, Buddha said that? You bet he did. Read it. And then when the Buddha went to Deer Park, did he want people to come and follow him and be at his feet? No. He had one desire, and that's to be at peace within himself and live in that state of nirvana that he knew and share it a little bit. And so people would say, teach us. And Sylvia, how did he teach them?
He lived it.
Ellen, how did he teach them? Say it. You can't just hold your hand up like that, and you see the audience can't see that. Now, go ahead, Ellen. What did the Buddha do? What did the Buddha do? What did the Buddha do?
He held up a flower. He held up a flower.
And said?
Meditate about this.
Meditate on this flower. And then he went back to his meditation. What did he do? He said, meditate on this flower. He didn't say, now, we've got to learn the 10 innerfold path and the 8 outerfold path and the 14 centerfolds, and you got to have this and that and the other thing, like the paths of the Patanjali and the paths of this and that and the other. He didn't say that. They said that of him. He didn't say that. He didn't talk. He virtually said nothing during his entire, 73 years or 71 years that he was fooling around, just having a ball. He did not speak to that, but we say he did. Now, it would be nice, Jesus talked a lot. It'd be nice if we had more of what Jesus said. That'd be kind of interesting, because it'd be very sound philosophy for us to consider. But it wasn't written down. But now the Buddha has written books, and he has done movies, and he has done videos and tapes and CDs, and he has done all this stuff. And you know why he's done that? Because he didn't do it. He didn't do those things so people can say he did those things, because people cannot be contradicted that he said it. Because there's nothing to prove that he did or didn't say those things anywhere in history. History has him saying, the Buddha, what number was he?
27.
The 27th Buddha. And where did he go to school? In his father's kingdom. In his father's kingdom, you know. And what did he learn in his father's kingdom? Nothing. He learned standard humanity. And then he left his father's kingdom to find what death, what injury, what hurt was all about, what those things were all about. And then what did he find? What did he find? He found nirvana. He found the ultimate peace. And he found that in nirvana, there is no what?
Suffering.
There is no suffering. There is no suffering in nirvana. And that's where the Buddha lived. And we want to say the Buddha was all these things. And we want to say that he was totally up on the Upanishads. He was totally up on all of the books and all of the writings of the Brahmins and so forth. The Brahmins took the Buddha into their fold because he was such a He didn't hurt anybody, you know. He didn't take anybody away from the Brahmin teachings, but he didn't lead anyone to it either. So they just took him in their fold and said he was a Brahmin. And they said that he was the 27th Buddha and that he knew all those things by heart. He knew them totally. Well, I would imagine he could say, like Jesus did, everything from within himself and know it. Because how many people in those days, in any day, have read the Bhagavad Gita? How many of those people have read the Upanishads? How many of those people have read that? They may know the story generally, but they don't know it as well as we know the Bible. And we don't know the Bible very well. And you begin to look at it. You see, here's the big thing about what people say about people like the Buddha and people like Jesus and so forth. They say that they are these things and they are not. They say that they are the 27th Buddha and their purpose is to live the teachings of the Upanishads and the the other books of the of their faith and their of the Brahmin faith and so forth. And that's not the thing at all. What is the Buddha's primary goal for himself in his life?
To be himself and have fun.
To be himself and have fun. In other words, to live in a state of nirvana. To live in a state of bliss. Is that bad?
That's super.
Now, did Jesus offer that same thing? Jesus gave you a little more verbiage about it. He said, go to your Father who is within and worship your Father who seeth in secret, and your Father who seeth in secret will reward you openly, you know. Well, the Buddha said the same thing. He says, go within and you got bliss and it's done. He said, what do you see when you see this flower? Now, Zarathustra, what did he say to his people? The king of Persia came to Zarathustra and said, teach me your philosophy. I understand you're a very great man. And Zarathustra said, I cannot do that. I will give you my teacher. Oh! So he reached down and picked up a seed and handed the seed to the king and said, here is my teacher. And the king says, bah! Humbug! And dashed off madly with his entourage, his horses, and his troops. Later he came back and apologized. But the thing is, you see, great people, great spiritual beings, great masters who are walking the path are not saying of themselves that they're great. They are, but they don't need to say it. They know that the greatness lies in them. And when Zarathustra gave the king the seed, what did the seed mean? The seed meant that the king has within him all truth, all knowledge, all awareness, all love, all peace, all goodness, and that the seed, once planted, now just fertilize it and nurture it and let it grow, and you will have the greatest indeed nation in the world. And when the Persian king came back and he admitted some humility, his kingdom became the greatest in the world. His kingdom did indeed become the greatest kingdom in the world. We look at Alexander the Great and the others and we think that their kingdoms were great, but they had a different kind of kingdom. The kingdom of the king of Persia was a kingdom of peace, a kingdom of inner tranquility, a kingdom of absolute independent wealth. Oh boy, nice stuff, you know. The kingdom of the king, study the king of Persia. You will be surprised what a noble, wonderful being this was and how his time spent with Zarathustra and Zarathustra's assistant, who Zarathustra sent to work with the king, how his whole life changed. But you see, theologians are looking for the words of Jesus because they got a lot of words to look with, and they're looking to see how they are said. And they're looking to see what they mean. And they're looking to see what they spell out. And they're looking to see whether they have any secret clues in it, you know. And this is what we do so much. We're looking for the secrets. I taught many years in many places. And one of them, of course, in Lugano. And my translator was Trudy Scher. And she is a very bright girl. A great lady, and she would say to me any number of times, Dr. Parley, you're telling them all the secrets. You're telling them all the secrets that no one should know, that no, they're not ready for this yet. And I said, you don't know half the secrets I tell because you're not ready for it. And if you're not ready for it, you won't get it. If you're ready for it, you'll say, yes, that's just what I think, that's just what I feel. But if you're not ready for it, you'll say, poppycock, nonsense, foolishness. You have been sitting here now with me for almost 5 days, 6 days, going on the sixth day now, tomorrow, and you have doubted me any number of times. You have felt that I was not giving you some sufficient material. And you were saying, Herb, you're putting us to sleep. And I was. Because you were totally out of it. You were totally spaced. You were so full of self-pride and self-belief that you're superior to me in every way, and you're not superior to me. Nobody can be superior to me, not even me. I listen to the divine within, and that's always changing. And one minute I might be one area, another another, and you too. But the thing is, when you think you're superior to whoever you're with, no matter who it is, whether it's just somebody you're setting the table with, or whether it's someone you're walking with, or whether it's someone you're listening to or learning from theoretically, whenever you feel superior to them, you have just drawn a blank curtain in front of your mind, and you have also started on the most terrible thing you could ever do in your life. You have started on the path to disliking yourself. Yeah. When you judge another person, and you judge life, and you judge circumstances that you place yourself in, you are starting yourself on the path of self-hatred that is just utterly amazing, destructive, totally. Now, how do you get out of that pit? How do you get out of that circumstance? Well, I'll ask you a question. How do you get out of that circumstance, Gertrude? What do you say?
I like
it. Ah, yes, yes, yes. See, you're on top of your other. See how quick you could answer that? I like me, I like me, I like me, I like me, I like me. You know, I was looking at Gregor's mound this morning. Gregor made a mound up here across from his bench for meditation. And in that mound, he spelled out in great big letters, in great big stones, I like me, with a big heart on the end of it. Well, most of the year, it's a dumpy little mound, filled with weeds, filled with stuff that you couldn't see the words. But in the past week or two, with the rains that we've had, and the gentle falling rain, the little green plants are growing up around it, and sort of enunciating the stones, and the stones are so washed clean of dust and everything, and it says, I like me. And you look at it and say, wow, we got to take some pictures of that while it's not dusty. But it's beautiful. Now, here Greg is going around the world, and what is the main thing he wants to say to himself is, I like me. Because Gregor has always said to himself, I'm not as good as the rest of them. I'm not as good as other people. I can't do the things they do. He's talented beyond imagination, but he goes around announcing to the world that he can't do things. And then the next moment, he turns around and does it with exquisite quality, you know. But he says it, and he believes it. And what a foolish thing to do. All he has to do is look at that mound that he built there, with that beautiful green background, the white stones like just diamonds, like just crystals standing there, sparkling in the morning sun, saying, I like me, shouting out to all the world. And all of us, we walk by there, we say, I like me. And we are saying his words. We are sending our blessing to him, even though we didn't know that it was his and that's what we're doing, what we are. When you say, I like me to yourself, do you know what you're saying? You're saying, God, I got a good mommy and daddy. The best. They created the best when they did me. I got a good mommy and daddy. That's what you're saying. And when you say, I like me, you say, I had a good family. My brothers and sisters were just super. They gave me a lot of pains in the neck, but because I was able to love them and not be bothered by the pain in the neck, I am super. I'm wonderful. I like me. I love me. You see, it goes on. It goes on to grandma and grandpa. It goes on to aunts and uncles. It goes on to teachers. It goes on to the stupid priests and ministers that you had in your churches. The rabbis, the dum-dums, you know. That's what you thought they were. Because you thought, why are they teaching this sort of nonsense that they talk about it and nobody does anything about it, you know? Well, this is why the theologians have such a difficult time. Because for some reason, people believe. For some reason, people have faith. For some reason, people have an inner dignity that is difficult to, you know, put words on or put any labels on. And you say to a person, are you a churchgoer? Oh, no, I don't go to church. Well, what do you do on Sunday? Well, I go out and sit in my garden, and I watch the flowers grow. And I go out and watch the birds as they're settling on the flowers. And you know, I even watch the worms. And I think, what glorious creatures the worms are. He doesn't go to church. She doesn't go to church. My goodness, what a beautiful church that is. Respecting, honoring, and worshiping the creation of the infinite, which they are. Now, people oftentimes say they don't believe in Jesus, or they don't believe in God, or they don't believe in anything. They're atheists. And then you say to them, now, let's take your kids into the porno theater down here. You know, your kids are 3 and 7 and 10 years old. Let's take them into the porno theater down here. Well, what do you think this is? That's nonsense. I don't have my children go there. Why not? Well, my children are better than that. They don't need to be brought up to think about things like that. Well, what do you think about? Well, they have beautiful bodies. They have beautiful minds. They have beautiful souls. So they have beautiful beingness. You see, even the greatest atheist has principles. Even the greatest atheist has things by which she guides her life and her world. And the greatest atheist really is perhaps the greatest treasure in heaven totally being. Because they don't worship an outer symbol. They worship the inner. And they respect the inner. And that's great, isn't it? What did Jesus say? Let the little children come unto me, for such is the kingdom of heaven. And if we honor our little children, if we honor them, we are honoring the kingdom of heaven. And how wonderful that is. Are you ready to live such a life? I think we are. But the theologians, they spend so much time working over the machinations of the words of Jesus, the words of the prophets, the words of these various people, that they forget the message. They forget the message of what the whole thing is all about. The whole thing is not about where Jesus spent his childhood, and where his brothers were or sisters were, and if they're stepbrothers and stepsisters, and if this and that and the other thing. I have people coming to me virtually all the time, and they say such a thing like this. They say, well, I remarried, and I have his children, and I have my children. And I say, I hope that you don't think that way. They say, what do you mean? I say, you have married this person and taken their children into your life. He has taken your children into his life. Do you want his children to be separate from your children in your thinking about them, in your blessing them, in your loving them? Or do you want to have the children be all equal, equally loved, equally appreciated? Oh, that's my daughter, his daughter, you know. And you see, the moment we pull those games, we have lost the love that Jesus teaches us. Love the little children, for such is the kingdom of heaven. When we ever judge, and that's judging for sure, when we ever judge, what we are doing is we are throwing away our recognition of the teachings of the story of Jesus, the teachings of his life. He taught all the time to love. He taught all the time to forgive. I don't teach to forgive, but he taught all the time to forgive. He taught all the time to forget. He taught all the time to put a new cause in motion. He taught all the time it's done unto you according to your belief. And why don't the theologians get hung up on that? Why don't they get hung up on that and say, now, he said, it's done unto you according to your belief. Now, what's your belief? And what's happening in your life? And wouldn't it be wonderful? Just think if research was done on that. On what people's beliefs are. Well, it has been. It has been. Women are tested on breast cancer, and they're told, okay, we're giving you a pill, and that pill is going to dissolve the breast cancer and you'll be free of it. And then the next group of women, in the same condition, they're told, now, we're going to give you this pill, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. Well, that's what they experience. Then they say, Now, what we're going to do to you is we're going to give you this layer of love, and we're going to have you watch how this layer of love completely dissolves anything unlike your perfect nature, and only your perfect nature comes through. And then they teach the energy massage of gently running the hands over the body and just letting the energy of the hand and the energy of the body meet and be a healing balm to itself, and only the wholeness and the purity of this energy manifests itself. And now, of those groups, they didn't call it energy body, but of those groups, which ones had the quickest remission of the cancer? Which ones had the total remission and no return of it? Which ones were slowest in coming around? Well, I had worked with this woman, doctor, nurse and doctor, and she taught the laying on of hands, not laying on of hands, but the energy. And what she taught was not the laying out of hands so much. She taught using the pills and using the energy, but she taught the caring of the doctor and nurse for the patient, the caring of the patient and how they feel about something. And when they would take their hands and they would put them on the woman's breast or on the woman's body where she was having this experience, and they would say, "I love you, I love you, I love you." They would say, "You are loved, you are wonderful, you are fantastic." And the patient would feel a great deal of heat emanating into their body and around their body and through their body. And within a very short time, whether days or whether weeks, but a very short time, the remission was there for them. Now, if that works so beautifully, why don't they all do it? Well, they don't all do it because it takes time. And that is not the money-making part of the business of healing cancer. Healing cancer, the money-making aspect of it is a surgery. And it is using those big, expensive pieces of equipment, you know, and using the pills, and lots of pills, and coming in for visits, and every visit costing a mint, you know. So I'm not saying any of these things are bad. Don't misunderstand me, or that you shouldn't do it. I'm only saying that Kruger was her name, Nurse Kruger. She was with us at the Menninger Foundation, and she was with us 3 years in a row, in fact. And she's the one who taught this touching. Nurses can do that. They can touch the woman's breast, and they can touch the body, and they can give the feeling of caring and loving. And she's written several books on it, in fact, and how absolutely successful it has been in working with patients, because not necessarily that they touched, not necessarily that they gave that heat feeling, not necessarily that they had the pills or anything else, but that they cared. They say the day of the doctor visiting a patient, a house visit, is gone. Now, Sylvia, I would imagine it'd be intelligent for you to pick up your stool and walk. Move out of the sun there. You do look gorgeous in there. The sun does give you a lot of glorious responses, reflections, just like a diamond. But I think that for your listening to me, it'd be a little better for you to move over. A little more. There you go. Perfect. Thank you. You see, we can care. And you say, "Herb, right in the middle of your lecture, right in the middle of your talk, right in the middle of when you are doing some very wonderful, profound, beautiful concepts, you tell someone to move their chair out of the sunlight. You take the time to make a house call. You take the time. Well, that's my life, my world. I really care. And I really care enough to get with you and say things to you about following whatever the program is that we have here for your benefit." And you could say, "Well, who needs it, you know?" Well, then you wouldn't be here if you didn't need it. Each one of you are here, no matter who you are or how long you've been here, each one of you are here because you're ready for whatever it is that I have to share. And when there's nobody here, I've done a good job. It's over. Nobody else to work with. Isn't that wonderful? Now, what would you say? Well, if there's nobody there, you're not doing a good job, and nobody comes back because they don't want to get what you're giving. Well, I tell you, no matter where I go in the world, I have a great burden that I carry with me. And the burden is, I love everybody unconditionally. That's a nice burden. I love everybody unconditionally, and I am called what, Ellen? No, I'm not. If you can't think of it right away.
The hugger.
Yeah. The hugger. Everywhere I go, I hug everybody.
The hug bug.
This was when they did it at me at the International New Thought Alliance conference. I went into the conference, and I hugged one woman, and she says, "I would rather you didn't do that." And I said to her, "Thank you, ma'am. That means I will hug everybody here without exception. And I started with you, so accept the fact that I love you." And she looked at me, you know. And then she saw me hugging everybody else. And she saw how much everybody was appreciating it and not judging it, not thinking I was trying to do something funny. And then she got in line too, you know. People, even at organizations like INTA, have such strange ideas sometimes about what hugging is all about. What hugging is all about. And hugging is all about absolute caring. I can hug you just peripherally, you know, just a little hug and let you slip away. Or I can snuggle you in a very loving way. Or I can embrace you with power and energy and infuse in you my deep, abiding concern and joy in being in your presence. Now, which would you like? And you don't have to answer me, I know. What is the greatest thing we can do for each other is to be uninhibited and hug each other. Now, when I take a hold of Dodie in my arms and I hug her, she's, "Oh my chest, oh my this, oh my that." I say, "Dodie, stop being so tense, relax." And she sort of folds up in my arms and she says, "Don't stop, you know." And you see, when you're tense, even Dodie, who knows better, is tense at first because she's been through so many manipulations with her body and with all the repair work that the surgeons have done over the years to sort of remodel her. And her real self is trying to come out. And I'm just squeezing that toothpaste tube to help it readjust itself and get in perfect alignment. But this is great. This is great. We can have so much fun, and we can have such a great joy. But the thing is, we have trouble because we are like the theologians. We always want to understand why. And I think if we could understand why in innocence, that'd be okay. But if we want to understand why in ignorance, then that's difficult. A little child says, "Mommy, why? Why?" And they mean it. They mean it more completely than we take it for what they mean. We think they're just bothering us. They're just a pain in the neck. And then we want to just get rid of them, get them off our back for a while we do a few other things around the house, you know. And this is brought home to me regularly with my child. I'm sitting at my desk, and my child comes up to me and brings this toy and bounces it on my lap and bounces it on me and says, "Come on, you can play for a while." And you know, how can you refuse Rex when he does this with so much love in his heart? And he says, "Well, if you won't play with me, I'll play with myself, but I'm a little rough." And then he takes his big long rope that he plays with, bang, bang, bang. And he just has such a good time. But when I take, say, 5 minutes and play with him and roll with him and just have a good time with him, just 5 minutes, he is so happy. He is so thrilled. He lays on his back and his feet up in the air and his mouth open saying, "Wow, wow, wow, I got the greatest dad in the world. He cares about me. He takes time off to be with me. He wants to be with me." See? And it only takes a few minutes. And if each one of us would do that with whoever our pet is, whether it's our friend, our husband, wife, or children, or our friends that we have who come over to visit now and then. When a friend comes over Do you give them a big hug? Do you give her a big hug? Do you say, I love you? And do you really mean it? You just hug the bejabbers out of them and you say, it's so nice to have you here. And then do you sometimes grab them and roll on the floor with them and just like you do with your dog, you know, and they say, are you crazy? You say, yeah, isn't that nice? And then after you roll on the floor with them, then you both lay back there and you say, hey, that was neat. I haven't done something so silly in a long time. And we should do that. You should see Gertrude. You go in Gertrude's house when nobody's around, and she's rolling on the floor with Luna, and Luna is jumping all over, and she's saying, isn't this wonderful? And then Luna comes over and brings her some of her hidden loot of candy, and Gertrude is supposed to eat this after Luna's been you know, working on it a little bit. And it doesn't bother Gertrude. Gertrude's past that. She's like a reborn mother having her fourth child or fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth, ninth child. And it's a wonderful thing. But the thing is, you let go. You let go. When Jerome comes in the house, Gertrude has no problem reaching over and hugging him and surrounding him and making him feel like he's the most great person in the world. And when Sabrina comes in the house, she's a little more sophisticated and she's a little more standoffish. And it's hard to get to love her the same way and snuggle her. But when you just grab her and you say, come here, you little honey bun. I love you. 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 You know, that unconditional love. She'll melt. She'll melt. And it's good for a whole day. One wonderful hug like that is good for a whole day. So imagine if you give a bunch of hugs like that every day. Wow! What magic takes place. You see, this is what our life is all about. This is what Jesus taught. He said, if someone comes and demands of you your coat, he says, don't just give them your coat, give them your cloak too. If someone demands of you anything, give it to them. If someone wants to come and sock you in the cheek, turn the other cheek so they can hit that one too. If you have anyone who disagrees with you, agree with your adversary quickly, and they become your best friend for life. But it takes humility. Humility on your part to say to someone, hey, I'm sorry I offended you. What can I do to amend things? Or what can I do not to do that again? You know? And he said, well, it wasn't that bad. It's okay. You're okay. You're all right. Yeah. And lo and behold, you see, this is what Jesus taught. This doesn't make sense to the theologians. You understand that? It makes no sense to the theologians because it is not based upon scientific principles, although it is. They think it's not based upon mathematical principles like music and astronomy and things like that. But it is based on it. Astronomy and music are based on the mathematical principles that love is based on. What is the cohesive glue force of the universe that keeps everything together? That doesn't let everything go plung off into nowhere? Love. And love in its many, many ways. Now, theologians can't understand that. And they can't understand that because it doesn't fit into their test tubes. It doesn't fit into their typewriters, you know. It doesn't fit into their understanding. And they're not to be thought terrible for not understanding. But we don't turn to theologians when we want to find out about love. We turn to the divine when we want to find out about love. And we don't turn to the doctors when we want to find out about healing. We turn to the divine in us when we want to find out about healing. The divine in us may say to us, now look, you blew this up so badly. Now you go to the doctor and let him give you a hand. But you just speak your word. I'm whole and perfect. I'm whole and perfect. I'm whole and perfect. But you let this go too far unless you want to transist and go on to the next dimension. That's okay. But our divine self even tells us to use the doctors. Our divine self even tells us to go and use the help of someone else. My brother-in-law was such a jerk, a loving jerk. He took care of his wife as she was in her difficult years of diabetes and everything else, and she was just really having a tough time. But he gave her 24-hour attention, and we told him, we said, Kip, take a break. Kip, take a break. And he wouldn't take a break. He wouldn't go off and have somebody come in and take care of his wife while he was gone. Or she always said, where are you, Kip? Where are you, Kip? Where are you, Kip? You know, and he felt so needed. And pretty soon, poof, he died. He just died because his soul, his spirit, his body gave up. It had had enough. It had been pushed to the limit. He hadn't taken time off to be relaxed and be at peace within himself. And then, of course, there she was. Stupid lady. She killed the man she loved, and he wasn't around to take care of her anymore. And so she had nothing to live for, so she died. I mean, I love her, but I can still say she was stupid for doing that. I told her, I said, May, tell Kip to get somebody in here to take care of you while he goes off and finds a movie or maybe even finds another lady. Yeah, oh, you know, and, you know, I tell her lots of things. And so, but she didn't want to let him go. She didn't want to let him go. And you see, that's called mistletoe. You know what mistletoe is? Mistletoe grows on the tree and eats the tree alive until there's no tree to feed it, to keep it alive. And that's a very unhappy situation to be in. Now, my sister May was not a bad woman in any sense of the word. She was as normal as apple pie. But in being that way, she also forgot that you cannot be possessive and keep it. Anita saw the cats in the garage, and the cats said, Anita, come here. You know, our kitty cats say that. And so Anita went in the garage. And in the garage, she saw the cats gathered around something in front of it. And here it was, a little bird. And the little bird was just laying there on the pavement. And it's a hummingbird. And so Anita said, well, thank you for sharing this with me. May I pick it up? And the cats let her pick it up. And she picked it up and she blessed it, blew on it, loved it, gave it all her joy, petted it with her finger. And she didn't hold her hand too tight because, you know, she didn't want to crush the little creature. But she held it for how long? An hour or so. But, you know, it was a good time. And then she gave it a drink of water, tried to give it something to eat, but, you know, that doesn't work. And so after a while, she petted it, and then it wanted to fly. And she says, okay, bye. But now, remember, I'm here for you. And so it flew up and around and came back on her hand. And then she said, you're doing good, you know. And then it flew away, and she was able to keep track of it at the feeder there for the longest time because it had a different attitude about it than the other birds had. And it was really quite beautiful. Remember that, Sylvia?
Yep.
It's quite a little bird, very colorful guy. And Ingeborg, your cats, you know, they called her to come and take care of this little guy. But you see, we always think birds and cats, you know, dong, they don't mix. And we think dogs and cats don't mix. And dogs and cats don't mix if they haven't been raised together. If they've been raised together, that's the most natural thing in the world. And boys and girls that are raised together are wonderful. But girls that are raised alone and boys that are raised alone, they have a sort of a fear of the other sex because they've never been close to them, never had them at the dinner table and other things like that. So, you see, love that Jesus taught is something indescribable, indecipherable by the theologians. And that's really the big problem there. Now, another thing that the theologians were so very upset about, they wonder why the Bible is interpreted so broadly and so imaginatively, creating the many religions. Well, we talked on that a little bit, but every minister feels that he knows what Jesus meant. You got me? Every minister thinks that he knows what Jesus meant. And so he's going to tell his congregation what Jesus meant. And every one of the parables that Jesus gave has at least 2,000 or 3,000 interpretations, according to different ministers who get up and talk about him. And they're charming. They're very charming. If you listen to some of them, you say, my God, how does he get that out of there? And other times you say, he shouldn't have gotten that out of there. Or other times you say, wow, what a magical response. I never would have thought it in that way. That's glorious and good and beautiful. You see, this is what is going on by the ministers. This is what's going on by the speakers. They take the words of Jesus, the parables of Jesus, the stories of Jesus, and they interpret them in what they feel are their everyday activities and how their everyday activities are being conducted. And they're just having a ball. They're just having a very good time. But the congregation is not getting anything from it. It is done unto you according to your belief. It is done unto you according to your belief. If the ministers would give the parable straight away like Jesus did, maybe put a little pizzazz in it like Jesus did too. And the two brothers were standing there, and the one brother said, why are you getting all of this favor from Daddy? You know, you ran away. You took your inheritance and you went out and blew it. And you were living in a pigsty and you don't deserve to be here. And the father said, son, you I have had with me always. He is the son who was missing for a while, and now he's returned, and we love him. Yeah, but Dad, yeah, but what about me? I've always been here. Son, you chose to be here. You didn't choose to leave. You chose to be here, and I love you here. But Dad, yeah, he chose to leave. But he also chose to come back because he found that this is his real home. This is where he finds happiness. This is whatever. And you see, can you see what the father can say? And you see how meaningful such a thing can be? Instead of saying, and the naughty son went out and he had a lot of harlots and he had a lot of bad things and he gambled and he did these things. Well, why emphasize that? Why emphasize that? Anyone may answer me right now, what did the son do?
Having fun.
My God, he came home.
Oh.
He came back. He came back. What would you do if your son were missing and he had been in some very bad circumstances with bad people and what have you, and he was just going to pot, and then all of a sudden he realized, hey, this is not what I want. And so he says, Mom, can I come home? And Mom says, son, you can always come home, but what about all of the things that you've been doing and you've been enjoying? Mom, I don't want them anymore. Son, you are welcome in my home totally. I love you, I love you, I love you. But you see, we have a right to ask the question. But the father of the prodigal son was even nicer than we were. He didn't ask the question. He knew the son was coming home because the son wanted what the father had to give. And you see, these are the stories of the Bible, and they are so simple if you could just interpret them in their simplicity instead of trying to make them so complex, you see? And most ministers make them so complex because they have a moral to tell. You see, when you blow all your estate, and you blow this here, and you blow that, and you come home, your father may still accept you, but your brother doesn't, and the rest of the gang at home, they're going to say, we'll wait and see if he really is a changed person. We'll wait and see. Well, the father doesn't say that. The father says, I know you are home, and that's all that I care about. I know that you are back in my heart, and that's all that I care about. You never left my heart. But I know that you're home again. And so if the son did blow it again, if he sort of had the need for going on drugs again or going off away from home again, so what? That's your son. Why is he doing these things? Why is he going through these things? Because of you. Somewhere in your relationship with him, in your life with him, you didn't give him the stability that would give him the strength to stand up to drugs. You didn't give him the strength to stand up to principle and to stand up to whoever he was, you know? And not, I don't want drugs. You don't have to say that. You just say, hey, guys, you're doing stuff that I'm not interested in, so you go ahead. I'll see you later. You know? No judgment. But I don't want drugs. And you don't have sex before you get married. And you don't do this and you don't do that. And my goodness, you know, those are all the things the kids want to do. Not because they want to do them, but because you said don't. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you had said to them, son, you know what is right and wrong, and just follow your right and wrong heart, and you will never make a mistake. And hey, you may get a kick in the tail for doing it. You may get a kick in the slats for doing it. In fact, you may even be put in prison for doing it, for saying, follow your heart, and always tell what you think is the truth. And you still do it. You still do it. You never change from what you believe is principle, what the teachings of Jesus are, what the Bible has told us all these centuries. You never change from it, even though you may have a rough time in the process. But as long as you stand up to what you believe, you stand up to the principle you believe, then that's all that's necessary. If you believe in yourself, who cares what anybody else believes? You understand? That's all that matters. It's hard. It's hard. But it's worth it. It's worth it. We've all been invited out by friends who wanted us to do things that weren't right, you know? And we said, no, thank you. Or we said, my mother doesn't like me to do stuff like that. That's silly to say that. We just say, no, thank you. Man, that guy's got character, you know. That woman's got character. Come on now, let's go to the party, and then we'll go and drink afterwards, and we'll do this, and we'll go to my place, and we'll do this. And the girl says, hey, let's go to the party. So they go to the party. She says, do you know, I would very much like to go home now. And, what ya babudo? I would very much like to go home. Would you mind? You're such a lovely person. I really appreciate it. So then he takes her home. And he says, can I kiss you goodnight? And she says, oh, our first date, I usually don't kiss goodnight. But you keep trying. I love you. I think you're nice. And she goes now. She is the boss. She is the master. He doesn't think badly of her in the slightest. He thinks, wow, I got to work on this one here, you know. This is worth cultivating. And you see, when you have character, you're worth cultivating. And now that's the type of moralism that Jesus taught. Go and sin no more. That's the kind of moralism that he taught. He taught to follow what your heart says, follow what you believe, follow what you know is true. Whew. And isn't it wonderful how time flies when you're having fun?
Yeah.
Well, Lecture 15, theologians, but not metaphysicians, wonder why the Bible is interpreted so broadly and so imaginatively, creating many religions, all claiming Jesus as their source. And the answer is, because it's good stuff. I love you. I love you.
I love you.